Good morning and welcome. My name is Michelle Stahl, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum with today's guest speaker, Erica Armstrong Dunbar. Please join me in thanking our musicians today, Fireside Winds. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding, world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. As many of you know, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum programs are recorded for New Hampshire Public Radio. Today's talk may be heard on NHPR two Sundays from now at 10 p.m. The talk will also be available on our website, monadnocklyceum.org, as a podcast within a few days. After the presentation, in keeping with the Lyceum tradition, the speaker has agreed to answer questions from the audience. The ushers will be collecting your questions toward the end of the talk. Please write them on the yellow cards provided. Following the program, we invite you to attend an informal reception in the parish hall, which is through the door to your left. There, you will have the opportunity to engage in further conversation with our speaker and to enjoy refreshments. In your pew, you will find a blue card. We hope you will give us feedback on today's program and join our mailing list and/or the email list. You can either mail the blue card to us or drop it in the bowls alone, or with your contribution to the sustainability of the Monadnock Lyceum. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is supported entirely through contributions from our audience members. We deeply appreciate your donations, which may be placed in the glass bowls in the church and in the parish hall. Thank you for your generous support. Our speaker today is Erica Armstrong Dunbar. Dr. Dunbar is the Blue and Gold Distinguished Professor of Black Studies and History at the University of Delaware and the author of A Fragile Freedom, African American Women and Emancipation in the Antebellum City, the first book to chronicle the lives of African American women living in the urban North in the early Republic. Dr. Dunbar appeared in The Abolitionists on PBS and has written for numerous publications, including The Philadelphia Inquirer, The Nation, and The New York Times. In 2011, she became the inaugural director of the Program in African American History at the Library Company of Philadelphia. The program brings together scholars and interested members of the public to explore and discuss the experiences of people of African descent in the Americas from the beginning of European colonization through 1900. In February of this year, she published her second book, Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. And she joins us today to share Ona's story. Please join me in welcoming Erica Armstrong Dunbar.
Thank you. Well, thank you, and good morning, and especially thank you for joining me on such a beautiful day outside. I know that to come in and to share an hour of time on a day that's so lovely, I appreciate that deeply. I also want to thank Michelle for the lovely introduction, my hosts, Joel and Anne, who are somewhere around. There's Anne doing, who've been so very kind and welcoming me while I've been here in New Hampshire. I adore coming to New Hampshire to talk about Never Caught. I've been here a couple of times since February and spent a good deal of time throughout the state while I was researching this book. And the audience and the readers here are so lovely, so it's wonderful to be back in New Hampshire. Today what I'll do is I'll talk a little bit about the book, how I came to sort of writing the book, and of course we'll leave some time for questions. But I also want to sort of give you a little bit of information about who Ona Judge was and why I felt so very compelled to tell this story, to write this story, and more specifically, to write a story for a general audience. As an academic, we're typically trained to write texts for other academics, which means sometimes it's a little boring, but, and I wrote one of those, not boring, but a different kind of writing for a different audience. And when I started this project, when I encountered Ona Judge in the archives, I realized I would have to present a different kind of history if I wanted to do her story justice. So I'll start with a quote. And this is a quote from Chinua Achebe, a very well-known, renowned Nigerian writer, poet. And he wrote, "Until the lions have their own historians, the history of the hunt will always glorify the hunter." And I begin with this quote because it explains my professional mission. I write the history of the lion. I write about phenomenal women who often find themselves written out of history. And today I'll share the story of one such woman. About 20 years ago, I was completing a bit of research for my first book, and I wanted to sort of get a feel for what life was like in the 18th century. And the best way to do that is to look through the newspaper. And of course, when we look through the newspaper in the 18th century, it's this way. Now it's sort of using your finger, going through digital tablets and what have you. But as a 19th century historian, I wanted my hands on the real deal. So I was in the archives looking through 18th century newspapers. And I came across an advertisement. And it was an advertisement for a runaway slave. It was 1796. That wasn't particularly odd for that moment in time. The newspaper had been printed in Philadelphia, so that was somewhat different in that slavery had already begun to be dismantled. But what was so very odd to me were the people that were involved, that were noted in the advertisement. A woman they named Ona Judge had run away from the president's house. And I stopped sort of short and realized I read the language, absconded from the household of the president of the United States, first sentence in the advertisement. So I'm doing my, okay, 1796, that's George Washington. Philadelphia, that's George Washington. And I paused and I asked myself, who was this woman and why don't I know her? What happened to her? Here I am becoming a historian, an expert in early African American women's history, and I don't know this name. That was problematic to me. I vowed to return to tell her amazing story that would really lead me on a 9-year trail. It took me 9 years to research and write this book. And those 9 years were long and difficult, but completely worth it, because I uncovered the life of one of the most incredible women whose lives I've ever encountered in the archives. So today I'll offer a bit of context, and I'll also read a bit from the book. But let me take you to 18th century Philadelphia. Spring rain drenched the streets of Philadelphia in 1796. Weather in the city of brotherly love was often fickle at this time of year, vacillating between extreme cold and oppressive heat. But rain was almost always appreciated in the nation's capital. It erased the putrid smells of rotting food and animal waste and filth that permeated the cobblestone roads of a new nation. It reminded Philadelphians that the long and punishing winter was behind them. Spring rain cleansed the streets and souls of Philadelphians. It was optimistic. It created a feeling of rebirth. And in the midst of the promises of spring, Ona Judge, a young, black, enslaved woman, received devastating news. She learned that she was to leave Philadelphia, a city that had become her home. Judge would travel back to her birthplace of Virginia and prepare herself to be bequeathed to her owner's granddaughter. Today, I'll introduce one of the most understudied fugitive slaves in America. At the age of 22, Judge stole herself from the Washingtons, forcing the president to show his slave-catching hand. As a fugitive, Judge would test the president's will and his reputation. The most important man in the new nation, heralded with winning the American Revolution, could not reclaim his enslaved woman. Ona Judge did what few people had done. She beat the president. Judge was never caught. Now, I'll admit, when this book came out in February of 2017, originally we thought about having the book come out in the fall of 2016, and I said, nope, there's going to be a presidential election. Everyone will be thinking about that. No one will think about Ona Judge. We'll have a woman president in the spring. The book will come out. Didn't quite shake out that way. And I'll be honest, for a moment I paused with a bit of concern. I thought, oh gosh, okay, so this election did not go as I had imagined it would. What does this mean for the publication of the book? I worried about other things first, and then publication of the book came next. And then I thought, and I realized that having a book published the month after the inauguration of our current president, it couldn't have been better timing to have a story about a 22-year-old black woman who defied the president of the United States. Timing was on our side. So I introduce a new American hero, an enslaved girl raised at Mount Vernon who, once exposed to the ideas of freedom, was compelled to pursue it at any cost. This was a woman who found the courage to defy the president, the wit to find allies, to escape, to outnegotiate, to run, and to survive. Her story is the only existing account of a fugitive once held by the Washingtons. It's quite possibly the only fugitive account of any 18th century enslaved person from Virginia. Judge's life exposes the sting of slavery, the drive of defiance. She guarded what she called her freedom every day of her life, never regretting her decision to fight for what she believed to be her right, and that was freedom. And I'm using that word freedom in this talk today. And originally, when the book was finished and we were thinking about titles, and I've always worked with the title Never Caught for the book, and my editor liked it, and so we took it to marketing, and they hated it. And there were suggestions, you know, Erica, you're giving the story away. And I paused for a moment and I said, well, you know, there have been other books and plays and narratives that do the same thing. Death of a Salesman, 12 Years a Slave. You know what's going to happen, right? Slave for 12 years, eventually that ends. And for me, it was very important to use the title Never Caught, as opposed to some of the other words that were suggested, using sort of free and freedom. The reality was that Ona Judge was never free. She was simply never caught. And the book helps us to understand what it meant to be a fugitive, to be a person who was legally enslaved, and to live your life as a fugitive, attempting to run constantly from slave catchers or looking over your shoulder, worrying about being detected. So while she lived as a free person, once she escaped the Washingtons, in reality, she was not. As I said, she was never caught. Ona Judge was born sometime around the beginning of the American Revolution, 1773, 74. We don't have an exact date of birth for her. The Washingtons, nor did many other slave owners, write down the date of the births of enslaved people. However, from records, and I thank genealogists at this moment and others who do family history that helped me sort of figure out exactly when Ona was born, we've sort of pinpointed 1773 to 1774. So she's born right at the birth of the new nation. At the age of 10, she found herself transition from childhood, really, to adulthood. Her mother, whose name was Betty, was an enslaved woman and was considered a dower slave. She was a slave that was owned by Martha Washington. Here's the sort of history lesson. Martha Washington was married once before George Washington, right? So George was her second husband. When she married, her husband passed away, leaving her an extremely large inheritance, one that consisted of tens of thousands of acres of land. She became one of the wealthiest women in the Chesapeake when she married George Washington. He came up in this marriage. And when they married, Martha Washington brought many of her enslaved men and women to Mount Vernon, and Betty, Ona's mother, was one of them. She came with her infant son, Austin, and I was able to track her life, or parts of her life, at Mount Vernon. At some point in 1772, 73, Betty became pregnant, and she gave birth to Ona. So technically, Ona was the property of Martha Washington and her heirs, not George Washington. George Washington clearly had slaves. He was born into a slaveholding family. At the age of 11, he inherited his own slaves and continued to purchase enslaved people for many years. However, Ona and Betty and her brother Austin and others were technically the property of Martha and her estate. Her father, Ona's father, was a white indentured servant by the name of Andrew Judge. George Washington had purchased his indenture agreement from Baltimore a year before Ona was born. I don't know the extent of the relationship, if it was that, between Betty and Andrew. I don't know if it was a coerced or forced encounter, or if there was a relationship that actually did develop between an enslaved woman and a white indentured servant. I don't have the answers to those questions, but what I do know is that Andrew Judge was her father. He was the only person with the surname of Judge at Mount Vernon, the only person with the surname of Judge in all of Fairfax County. Ona Judge was referred to as having a last name, one of the very few at Mount Vernon. Andrew Judge, her father, was a tailor, known for making some of the more important costumes, or rather revolutionary garb, that George Washington wore in battle. Andrew was a tailor. Ona's mother, Betty, was a seamstress. Their paths would have crossed frequently. At the age of 10, Ona was brought up to the Mansion House to follow in her mother's footsteps. She became a seamstress and a spinner, but she also moved up in the ranks of the household and in some way, or for some reason, became Martha Washington's, and I'm sort of still missing the right nomenclature for this, but she became Martha Washington's top slave. Her top slave, the person that Martha Washington turned to for everything. By 1789, George Washington was elected unanimously to become the first president of the United States, and he would have to travel to New York, the site of the nation's first capital. I'm fueled by all of the popularity of Hamilton. All of my college students now know that the nation's capital was in New York, so thank you to Lin-Manuel for making my job a little easier during the day. Washington traveled to New York, and he traveled alone, meaning Martha Washington did not come with him. She was unhappy about having to leave Virginia. She didn't want to go. Sounds familiar. As he traveled to New York, he would send letters back and forth to Virginia, as would his secretary Tobias Lear, attempting to make Martha Washington want to come to New York. Of course, it was the 18th century. Of course, George Washington was her husband, and of course, Martha Washington would eventually come to New York. And when she came, she would bring 7 enslaved people with her. One of those people was Ona Judge. Ona would be taken from her mother, Betty, and her other siblings that remained in Virginia. Let me read a bit from the book, this moment that Ona is forced to leave Virginia. The young Ona Judge was far from an experienced traveler. The teenager knew only Mount Vernon and its surroundings and had never traveled far from her family and loved ones. For Judge, the move must have been similar to the dreaded auction block. Although she was not to be sold to a different owner, she was forced to leave her family for an unfamiliar destination hundreds of miles away. Judge would have no choice but to stifle the terror she felt and to go on about the work of preparing to move, folding linens, packing Martha Washington's dresses and personal accessories, helping out with the grandchildren were all the tasks at hand. And it wasn't her place to complain or question. Judge had to remain strong and steady, if not for herself, then for her mistress, who appeared to be falling apart at the seams. Like Judge, Martha Washington had no choice about the move to New York. Her life was at the direction of her husband, who was now the most powerful man in the country. Mrs. Washington and Ona Judge may have shared similar concerns, But of course, only Martha Washington was allowed to express discontent and sorrow. Martha Washington was unhappy, and everyone knew it, including her frightened slave. The president's nephew, Robert Lewis, would also soon be made aware of it. When he arrived at the estate on May 14th, things were in disarray. Lewis, who served as Washington's secretary between 1789 and 91, was chosen to escort his aunt and her grandchildren to New York, but was surprised and a bit concerned when he arrived to find a frenzied and hectic scene. Lewis wrote, quote, "Everything appeared to be in confusion," end quote. The manifestation of Mrs. Washington's conflicting feelings. Robert Lewis described the departure, which finally took place on May 16th, 1789, as an emotional moment for the slaves and the First Lady. He wrote, quote, "After an early dinner and making all necessary arrangements, in which we were greatly retarded, it brought us to 3 o'clock in the afternoon when we left Mount V. The servants of the house and a number of the field Negroes made their appearance to take leave of their mistress. Numbers of these poor wretches seemed greatly agitated, much affected. My aunt equally so," end quote. Betty, Ona Judge's mother, must have been one of those agitated slaves. Not only was she losing her 16-year-old daughter, but she was also losing her son, Austin, who would serve as one of the Washington's waiters. Austin's wife, Charlotte, and their children would have joined in the mourning. Betty watched her children leave Mount Vernon, a reminder of what little control enslaved mothers had over the lives of their children. If she found any comfort that day, it would have been that brother and sister were traveling together. Austin was older and male and could look out for his younger sister, but still, Betty knew that her relationship with her children would never be the same. So this marks the moment in which Ona Judge leaves the South, and for the most part, would live the remainder of her life in the North. She had no idea how long she would be stationed in New York, and that quickly sort of became clear. The nation's capital moves to Philadelphia in 1790, and Lin-Manuel helps with that knowledge as well for my college kids, students. So her time in New York was relatively short, but it was important because it was the first time in which Ona Judge encounters a large free black population. In New York, there was still a significant number of enslaved people, tens of thousands to be exact. But it was the first time that she saw black men and women and children without owners. And when they moved to Philadelphia in November of 1790, this experience escalates. 1796, Philadelphia. 6 years later, Ona had spent a good number of years in the city known for being the nation's birthplace, but also a city that had the largest free black population in the new nation. At the moment of Ona's arrival in 1790, there were about 100 enslaved people living in Philadelphia, 6,000 free blacks. And many wonder why. Why did Ona actually have to travel south a bit from New York to Philadelphia to encounter a free black community? Well, in part, there were many things that made Philadelphia and Pennsylvania known for this free black community. They had changed the laws. They had changed the laws about slavery so that by the time that Ona arrives, she is in the minority as an enslaved person. The Gradual Abolition Act of 1780 in Pennsylvania began to dismantle slavery, only allowing people to remain in bondage for up to 28 years. I say only, recognizing that that was half of a person's life in the 18th century. But what it did was begin the process of freedom. So that 10 years later, when Ona arrives, she is one of very few enslaved people. And I think about the caravan of men and women who welcomed the Washingtons into the city of Philadelphia, applauding and cheering the new president. But I also think about the free black men and women along the sides of the road who watched their new president bring 9 enslaved people with him. When he arrives in Pennsylvania, George Washington, that is, realizes that his situation regarding enslaved people living with him in the executive mansion was fragile. He was told by his attorney general that the Pennsylvania law required non-residents to only be in Pennsylvania for up to 6 months with their slaves. And after 6 months expired, their enslaved men and women were entitled to freedom. This worried the Washingtons. George and Martha Washington and their secretary, Tobias Lear, wrote back and forth to one another, trying to figure out how to handle this thorny situation. And what they did was come up with a slave rotation plan. Every 6 months, George Washington and Martha Washington would shuffle their slaves back to Virginia, restarting the clock of enslavement. If travel to Virginia was too much of a problem or a burden, a quick trip across the river to Trenton would, in essence, restart the clock as well. George Washington circumvented the law. He did not break it, but he broke the spirit of the law in Pennsylvania. And he wrote in his letters to Tobias Lear, quote, "I wish to have it accomplished under the pretext that may deceive both them," the slaves, "and the public," end quote. So this is one of those moments as a historian where I'm sitting in the archives reading George Washington's letters, and I'm like, George, George, really? Really? These are his words, not mine. So for the next 6 years in Philadelphia, the Washingtons were fairly vigilant about shuffling their slaves in and out of the state in order to hold on to them, in addition to the 9 enslaved people who would work in Philadelphia for the Washingtons. They had scores of white servants living in their household, teams of secretaries, and it was always interesting to me, why bring slaves to Philadelphia in the first place? Why not just use white servants or free black servants? But it was something that the Washingtons were unwilling to do. They brought a bit of home with them. So while this was a difficult situation, it was perhaps confusing, perhaps glorious, perhaps maddening for Ona Judge and the other enslaved men and women to be shuffled in and out of Philadelphia, experiencing what it meant to be around a community of free black people, and then the reminders of home in Virginia. Yes, it was an opportunity to see loved ones and friends and family, but it was also a reminder of the absence of Black freedom. And coming home to Philadelphia, Ona would have opportunities not only to live in a much more cosmopolitan way. She went to the circus, she went to the theater, but she also watched Black freedom unfold in front of her. She saw Black men and women selling their pepper pot soup and their fruits and their oysters on the streets as free, independent entrepreneurs. She watched the building of Mother Bethel Church around the corner from her home. And all of this contested her existence as an enslaved person. And this came to a head in February of 1796. The post arrived in February, and George and Martha read through the mail and were surprised to receive a letter from their granddaughter, Eliza Park Custis. Now, just a reminder, the Washingtons, George and Martha Washington, had no biological children together. George Washington never had biological children. Martha did. She had a number of children from her first husband, all of whom were deceased by the time he became the president of the United States, George Washington. So she only had her grandchildren left. She suffered through great trauma as a woman in the 18th century. Many did, not watching their children live up through adulthood. And for that reason, she actually took two young grandchildren in to live with her and George Washington in the Executive Mansion in both New York and Philadelphia, perhaps one of our most famous examples of grandparents raising grandchildren. They got a letter in the mail from Eliza, who was older, 19, did not live with the Washingtons, acknowledging that she was to be married. She was marrying a man who was 20 years younger than she. Older. That would have been even more interesting, right? But the records say 20. 20 years older than she. He had spent a good deal of time in India as a businessman and was a speculator. He came to the new federal city with two of his three biracial Indian children. So he was a total wild card for the Washingtons. And so this announcement took them off guard, and it worried Martha Washington, who, as I said, only had grandchildren to care for. So she made a decision. She made a decision that while she could not change Eliza's mind, and Eliza was known for being a sort of volcanic, somewhat temperamental woman, although perhaps she was just an 18th century woman with a mind of her own, she knew the only way that she could help her granddaughter was to give her her very best slave. And so she promised Ona Judge to Eliza. I'll read briefly from the book, because it's this moment, this decision to give Ona Judge away as a wedding gift to Eliza Park Custis Law, that triggered Ona Judge's escape. Judge knew what the future held should she not heed the advice of her free Black associates. She supposed if she went back to Virginia that she would never have a chance to escape. Once she learned that upon the decease of her master and mistress, she would become the property of a granddaughter of theirs by the name of Custis, she knew that she had to flee. She imagined that her work for the laws would begin immediately, not after the death of her owners, prompting a fierce clarity about her future and her dislike for Eliza Custis, Ona would later say, quote, "I was determined never to be her slave," end quote. Her decision was made. She would risk everything to avoid the clutches of the new Mrs. Law. Judge was well informed. She knew that her decision to flee was far more than risky, but still she was willing to face dog-sniffing kidnappers and bounty hunters for the rest of her life. Yes, her fear was consuming, but so too was her anger. Judge could no longer stomach her enslavement, and it was the change in her ownership that pulled the trigger on Judge's fury. She had given everything to the Washingtons. For 12 years, she had served her mistress faithfully, and now she was to be discarded like the scraps of material that she cut from Martha Washington's dresses. Any false illusions she had clung to had evaporated, and Judge knew that no matter how obedient or loyal she may have appeared to her owners, she would never be considered fully human. Her fidelity meant nothing to the Washingtons. She was their property, to be sold, mortgaged, or traded with whomever they wished. And it was knowing that her ownership would change, knowing that she would no longer be in the position of Martha Washington's top slave, knowing that she was leaving Philadelphia, all of this prompted Ona to escape. And on Saturday, May 21st, 1796, as the Washingtons ate their supper, Ona Judge left their house and never returned. And it was this moment that the pursuit of Ona Judge began. So the title of the book is Never Caught, but the second part, of course, is the Washingtons' relentless pursuit of their runaway slave, Ona Judge. And it's the pursuit that is the second part of the book. The pursuit is what takes place here in New Hampshire. And while I don't have time today to talk about her life as a fugitive in New Hampshire, and also because I want you to buy the book, I'm gonna keep you in suspense. Can't give it all away. You know the title, but you don't know the pursuit part, right? But what's important to note, and in closing, is that George and Martha Washington would spend the rest of their lives pursuing Ona Judge. And for the next few years, Ona Judge would be hunted by George Washington and his appointed officials. And she would be forced to live a life as a fugitive in hiding. And although she spent nearly 50 years as a fugitive in hiding, I'm certain that she never wanted to be forgotten. And so it's with great pleasure that I've had the opportunity to introduce her story and her life to the world. And I thank you for your attention today. Thank you.